Today is August the 22nd, 2018.
Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, my colleague is Joe King, and podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. A long-promised integration between the Amazon Alexa voice assistant and Microsoft's Cortana has finally come to life after a year of waiting. To use it, just ask Alexa to open Cortana. Or if you're on Windows 10 PC, ask Cortana to open Alexa. Cortana has integration with Microsoft Outlook for email and calendaring that Alexa and other similar systems don't. If you own an Amazon Echo speaker, you can now finally speak to Microsoft's Cortana assistant, if you so choose. Also, at long last, you can now use Cortana on Windows 10 PC to talk to Amazon's Alexa assistant. The intermingling of intelligent assistants come almost a year after it was promised. Last August, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella announced that companies were teaming up to integrate Alexa and Cortana. In January, Microsoft told reporters that the Alexa integrations were in its final stages of testing, and that was pretty much the only public update from either company about the partnership since the initial announcement. Until now, if you're talking to Amazon's assistant from any Alexa-powered device, you can now just say, "Alexa, open Cortana." From there, you can access a handful of features that are exclusive to Microsoft Assistant. For example, you can have it read to you emails sent to your corporate account or list your upcoming appointments that were scheduled in Microsoft Outlook. Similarly, from Windows 10 computer, you can now say open Alexa after you launch Cortana. You can then ask Amazon's assistant to do anything it could do on the Echo speaker, including purchase items from Amazon, play songs from Amazon Music, or play games such as Jeopardy. The companies are cautioning users that this is a public preview of the integration of the assistants and it's not a fully baked release yet. By the way, I've been testing it. It does work. On its surface, the partnership between the two companies would seem an unlikely one. Not only do Alexa and Cortana ostensibly compete with each other, but Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure, the two companies' cloud computing services, are arch rivals. However, the partnership is a strategic move for both companies. Amazon, which failed to establish its own devices or operating system as significant players in the smartphone market, has been aggressively pushing its intelligent assistant, seeing voice as the next major computing platform. The endeavor has been dubbed Alexa Everywhere. Every speaker, appliance, and now PC that you can use to talk to Alexa can serve as a channel to the wide world of Amazon's goods and services. By most measure, Alexa is a leading voice assistant, with about one out of every four home now has an Alexa unit, edging out the Google Assistant. The deal with Microsoft gives Amazon another beachhead in its attempt to dominate the market. Earlier this year, in a related move, Amazon announced partnerships with HP, Acer, Asus for special Alexa-equipped PCs. For Microsoft, the deal gives it a chance to promote Cortana to a new audience. The company has long hyped Cortana's integration with Outlook and its other corporate tools in an attempt to lure its users. But in terms of catching on with consumers on electronic makers, Cortana has trailed far behind Alexa and Google Assistant. Only one smart speaker on the market supports Cortana. Microsoft Assistant integrates with far fewer smart home appliances than its rivals, and there are far fewer Cortana-specific apps. By bringing Cortana to Alexa, Microsoft can potentially reach users on devices other than PCs. But it's an open question whether Alexa users will actually take advantage of that option. I could see its use. I will report on it in a future report if I can find this useful at all. On the internet, companies like Google and Facebook get their revenue from the number of subscribers that visit websites, such as Facebook, in terms of how many subscribers they have in their database. Or in the case of Google, how many clicks there are when people are viewing advertising pages, or the number of pages that are viewed, or even the dwell time on how long they spend watching or reading a particular page on the internet. The crux of all this is that the statistical information is provided by people like Google and Facebook, and the accuracy of it is taken at face value as being accurate. Is it? Facebook brags it has a massive real audience, estimated to be about 2.23 billion monthly users and 1.47 billion daily users, and this is after they have deleted 1.27 billion fake accounts. The inference in all that is that now that all these fake accounts are out, the other numbers of 2.23 billion monthly and 1.47 billion daily, those are real accounts. However, the social networking giant's math is being challenged now in a lawsuit that claims that this potential reach is exaggerated, thereby defrauding advertisers. In other words, it is alleged that the information is not quite as many eyeballs are seeing Facebook ads. Potential reach is an estimation of how many people are in an ad set's target audience. This estimation is a unique calculation by Facebook and isn't intended to align with third-party calculations or population census data. In a complaint filed this past week in a U.S. District Court in Oakland, California, the plaintiff company, Project Therapy, claims that the potential reach and estimated daily reach figures that Facebook provides to advertisers are wildly inflated. And they give examples of this. The complaint claims that Facebook purported potential reach among 18 to 34-year-olds in each U.S. state is greater than the actual population of 18 to 34-year-olds in each of those states. By the way, the 18 to 34 are the millennials. Based on publicly available information and research done by the plaintiff, and their own analysis is that among the 18 to 34-year-olds in Chicago, for example, Facebook asserted its potential reach was approximately four times, in other words, 400% higher than the actual number of real people age 18 to 34-year-old. And with Facebook accounts in Chicago, well, that's a big, huge distortion in number. And in Kansas City, the complaint asserts the number provided by Facebook was 200% or two times higher than the actual number of people with Facebook accounts in the area. Well, it sounds like it's inflated. And what's more, the court filing contends that former Facebook employees, described as confidential witnesses, have acknowledged that Facebook is, well, they're using inflated numbers. The complaint states, a former Facebook employee who worked in the infrastructure mapping team stated that those who were responsible for ensuring the accuracy of the potential reach at Facebook were indifferent to the actual numbers, and in fact, they didn't really care what numbers they had. This unidentified individual allegedly also said the potential reach statistic is like, well, it's made up PR number. A second former Facebook employee is said to have observed that Facebook does not care about the accuracy of information related to the number of users so long as advertising revenue is not negatively affected. And a third former employee described as saying that Facebook isn't interested in keeping fake accounts out of the potential reach calculations. The attorneys representing Project Therapy are seeking class action certification in order to represent by other affected Facebook advertisers. The attorneys representing Project Therapy is reported to have spent over $14,000 on Facebook ads, and they are seeking class action certification in order to represent other affected Facebook advertisers. Facebook, however, dismissed the allegations in an email and said that this suit is without merit and we plan to defend ourselves vigorously, said the VP and Deputy General Counsel at Facebook. If Facebook loses in this, are they going to have to make adjustments and return a lot of the revenue dollars they receive based on false advertising numbers? Facebook has a credibility gap, tremendous credibility gap.
Hank, are you sure about that, about Facebook lying, not telling the truth about how many members? Oh, come on. I don't believe that for 1 minute. Facebook, the people who arranged for Russian spies to fix the last election, Facebook, the people who don't know when they even have a phony account, Facebook, no, they would never lie. Oh, come on.
The following computer news headline was reported by 10 different sources, and the headline all were the same. Firefox add-on with 220,000 plus installs caught collecting users' browsing history. And it went on to say that Mozilla has removed web security from its add-ons portal, along with 22 other add-ons. A popular Firefox add-on is secretly logging users' browsing history, according to the reports. The add-on in question is named Web Security and is currently installed by 220,746 Firefox users, according to the official Mozilla add-on portal. The add-on's description claims Web Security actively protects you from malware, tampered websites, or phishing sites that aim to steal your personal data. Mozilla previously had recommended this add-on in a blog post by them. Its high install count and positive reviews got the add-ons on the list of recommended security and privacy add-ons on the official Firefox blog. But this boost of attention from the Mozilla team didn't go down as intended. A blogger reported on Reddit that the add-on exhibited a weird behavior. He said, with this extension, I see that for every page you load in your browser, there is a post to, and then there is a URL with it. The blogger said that the data is garbled, and maybe someone will have the time to investigate further. He issued this warning, and it went under the radar for a few days until another German blogger posted an article about the same behavior. A user on another forum managed to decode the garbled data, revealing that the add-on was secretly sending the URL of visited pages to a German server. And the conclusion was that web security was caught collecting user browsing patterns. Well, under normal circumstances, a Firefox add-on that needs a scan for threats must be entitled to check the URLs it scans on a remote server. But according to a format of the data the add-on was sending to the remote server, it appeared that web security was logging more than current URLs. The data shows the plugin tracking individual users by an ID along with a browsing pattern. This logging pattern is a bit excessive and differs from Mozilla's add-on portal guidelines that prohibit add-ons from logging users' browsing history. Mozilla had removed two similar add-ons, Stylish and Web of Trust, from its add-on portables for similar behavior in the past. A spokesman for the software, Creative Software Solutions, made the following statement. The add-on web security is, as the name says, is a security add-on that protects the user from abusive websites to protect their data and privacy. We do not want sites to track and steal the user data or browsing history. One of the security aspects includes checking the requested site against a global blacklist. Thus, the communications between the client and our server is unavoidable. While we keep it to an absolute minimum and do not log this communication, our servers are all in Germany, thus we are also bound by GDPR and only process data for the specified reasons. Our add-on has also been processed by Mozilla's stringent verification staff, which have specifically approved all communications that occurs. All data transferred should communicate securely. However, as we take these privacy concerns very seriously, I have already informed the developers to investigate the issue at hand and to verify and improve if possible. And it turned out the add-on was not banned, and Mozilla has not removed it from the add-on portal. And they also removed the blog post that issued the warning. Mozilla engineers usually review add-ons with reported suspicious behavior and ban them if necessary. and this process takes a few days before it takes effect. What is the net of all this? It turns out it was a false positive. But the headlines indicated otherwise, and sometimes you can't believe all the headlines you read. You have to read the content itself, and you have to read the details. There should have been better journalistic reporting on this. My advice to the users is, when you read a computer news item, I don't care whether it's a computer news item or political news item or any other item, you got to read the details carefully and you have to vet what you read. Remember a couple weeks ago we were talking about Google tracks your location, or they maintain a location history and knows where you are even when the machine is turned off. Well, Google issued a clarification, said that they don't do it, and they gave you a description on how you go about turning it off. Well, people took them on it, and Google came up with a revision titled Erroneous Description on its website of how location history settings works, and then saying that it continues to track users even if they disable the setting. Wait a minute, that's not what they said. The change came 3 days after the AP investigation revealed that several Google apps and websites store users' locations. Even if users have turned off location history, Google has not changed its location tracking practice in that regard. But its help page for the location history setting now states, "This setting does not affect other location services on your device." It also acknowledges that some location data may be saved as part of your activity on other services like search and maps. Wait a minute, search and maps is a Google product. Previously, the page stated, with location history off, the places you go to are no longer stored. Well, the AP observed that the change occurred midday last week, and a finding confirmed by Internet Archive snapshot taken early in the day. The AP investigation found that even with location history turned off, Google stores user location when, for instance, the Google Maps app is open, or when users conduct Google searches that aren't related to location. Automated searches of the local weather on some Android phones also stored the phone's whereabouts. Google said the following, "We have been updating the explanatory language about location history to make it more consistent and clear across our platforms and help centers." The statement contrasted with an earlier statement that Google sent to AP, and it said in part the following, "We provide clear description of these tools." A Princeton computer scientist and former chief technologist for the FCC said the wording change was a step in the right direction, but it doesn't fix the underlying confusion that Google created by storing location information in multiple ways. The notion of having two distinct ways in which you can control how your location data is stored is inherently confusing. He also noted that he is not aware of any other major online services that set up their architecture to have multiple location privacy settings. Huge tech companies are under increasing scrutiny over their data practices, following a series of privacy scandals at Facebook and new data privacy rules recently adopted by the European Union. Last year, the business news site Quartz found that Google was tracking Android users by collecting the addresses of nearby cell phone towers, even if all location services were off. Well, Google changed the practice and insisted never recorded the data anyway. Critics say that Google's insistence on tracking its user location stems from its drive to boost advertising revenue. It can charge advertisers more if they want to narrow ad delivery to people who visited certain locations. Several observers also noted that Google is still bound by a 20-year agreement it struck with the FTC, and that consent decree requires Google to not represent to consumers how they protect their privacy. Google agreed to that order in response to an FTC investigation of its now-defunct social networking service, Google Buzz, which the agency accused of publicly revealing users' most frequent Gmail contacts. A year later, Google was fined $22.5 million for breaking the agreement after it served some users of Apple's Safari browser's so-called tracking cookies in violation of settings that was meant to prevent that. The FTC has declined to say whether it has begun an investigation of Google for how it has described location history. Well, I expect Google to make some changes quickly, otherwise they're going to get everyone on their back, and no one will end up believing anything they say.
Google has now been sued by a man in San Diego, and at the same time, activists in Washington, D.C. are urging the Federal Trade Commission to examine whether the company is in breach of its 2011 consent decree with the agency. In the lawsuit, which was filed in federal court last Friday in San Francisco, attorneys, notice I said attorneys in the plural, representing the plaintiff argued that Google is violating the California Invasion of Privacy Act and the state's constitutional right to privacy. The lawsuit seeks class action status, and it would include both an Android class and iPhone class for the potential millions of people in the United States with such phones who turn off their location history and nonetheless had it recorded by Google. However, the judge has to determine whether it qualifies as a class action act. HCL is an Indian outsourcing company charged with gaming the H-1B visa program. Indian workers have dominated the H-1B system with 2.2 million H-1B applications submitted for Indian workers in the last 10 years, according to U.S. government data. China, the country with the next largest number of applicants, had only 300,000 visa requests. Pew Research reported last year that more than half of all the H-1B visas were awarded to Indian citizens in the last 14 years. The U.S. H-1B visa is a non-immigrant visa that allows U.S. companies to employ graduate-level workers in specialty occupations that require theoretical or technical expertise in specialized fields such as IT, finance, accounting, architecture, engineering, mathematics, science, and medicine. Outsourcing companies that obtain U.S. work visas to place foreign workers in U.S. companies have become a target for critics of the H-1B visa program, and a new lawsuit will likely add fuel to the fire. Indian outsourcing company HCL discriminates against non-Indian citizens in hiring and promotions, firing them at higher rates than Indian workers in a new lawsuit. HCL did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The lottery-based H-1B visa, intended for highly skilled jobs, have attracted the wrath of critics who point to reported abuses by outsourcing firms and claim it is used to replace American workers with foreign nationals. Silicon Valley's tech industry relies heavily on the H-1B and has lobbied for an increase to the annual 85,000 cap on new visas. Reese Vohl, a white male computer systems architect who said in his lawsuit that he worked at HCL for 2 years until he was terminated in August of 2016, alleges the company prefers South Asians in employment decisions and has implemented a number of corporate practices to put its bias into action. The suit said HCL's South Asian workforce is primarily Indian. Vohl is seeking class action status for the lawsuit, which was filed in U.S. District Court in San Jose. Among the corporate practices adopted by HCL is filling the U.S. workforce with Indian citizens working under the H-1B visa. HCL submits visa petitions for more positions than what actually exists in the United States in order to maximize its chances of securing the highest number of available H-1B visas from the lottery process. In this way, HCL has been able to secure visas for far more individuals than it actually has a present need for. All and virtually all of the H-1B visas that HCL obtains are for South Asian, the suit said. Foreign citizens with H-1B are given preference over workers already in the United States. Non-South Asian individuals are often displaced from their current positions in favor of South Asian and visa-ready individuals, and jobs are given to visa-holding South Asians from India.
The suit was filed in federal court as it claims HCL employment practices violates U.S. civil rights law. Outsourcing firms have traditionally taken the largest number of H-1B visas. The H-1B is obtained by companies, and in 2016, three of the top five recipient firms were Indian outsourcers. Pew reported last year that HCL was eighth on the list of the top H-1B recipients in 2016, receiving about 3,500 visas, according to Pew. The leading recipient was New Jersey-based Cognizant, with over 21,000 H-1B approvals in 2016. HCL preference for Indian workers means it promotes them at higher rates than non-South Asians, and it terminates non-South Asians at higher rates. Vol claims that in the 2 years he worked for HCL in Texas, he witnessed the company preference for Indian workers firsthand. Vol also claims he was unable to collaborate properly with the co-workers. South Asian colleagues routinely spoke in Hindi and other non-English languages, both socially and while discussing client-related work, precluding Vol from fully participating in these conversations. Vol said in the lawsuit that he was terminated after HCL removed him from his computer systems architect position and that his subsequent applications for a position in the company was unsuccessful. Vol wants the court's approval to bring in as co-plaintiffs all individuals who are not of South Asian race who applied for positions with or within HCL in the United States and were not hired, and who were employed by HCL in the United States and sought a promotion but not promoted, and all who were employed by HCL in the United States and were involuntarily terminated. He is seeking unspecified damages and compensation, plus a court order forcing HCL to adopt a non-discriminatory method for hiring, promotion, termination, and other employment decisions. The following is an unpleasant subject, but it's something that we need to address. Estate planning should include deletion of online accounts. None of us like to think about our death or the death of loved ones. When it comes to property assets, we are advised to draw up a will. The primary purpose of a last will and testament is to assure that your property is distributed as you wish after you die. A will is a written document that directs the distribution of your property at death, states who will care for and distribute your property, and names a guardian to care for your minor children. In this modern digital age, we now also need to include information on identifying and closing existing online accounts. Coping with the death of a loved one is often a devastating emotional and psychological process, and for those who have been asked with this process, are tasked with tying up the loose ends of a late friend or family member, it probably doesn't help when you've got to repeatedly explain to a seemingly endless string of customer service reps why they can't speak to the account holder. It is impossible to avoid all frustrations when trying to close those accounts for late loved ones. However, there are steps to take in advance to ensure that the smoothest possible transition can take place. Prepare ahead of time by appointing a power of attorney or an executor for your estate. Update pertinent documents. Make sure your financial, digital, and medical documents, as well as your will, are up to date. Create a list of your accounts that should be closed. The information needs to be reviewed and updated whenever there are changes. Have relevant paperwork on hand. In other words, don't just leave it on the machine. Once someone you have loved have passed, make sure you make plenty of copies of the death certificate. Unfortunately, you likely have to provide this document many times. Also, make sure you know the personal information for the deceased, including passwords and social security number. In a situation where death is imminent, preparation, however grim a task, it might be of help to alleviate some of the stress when you eventually do have to box up your loved one's life. But even those who think they've got everything planned in advance, you may be surprised when you hit roadblocks you hadn't accounted for. We all have tons of digital accounts, email, social media, shopping, cable services, and the list goes on and on. If you ever need to close one of these accounts by yourself or perhaps a loved one who have passed away. eBay, for example, you need to have the balance of the account and set to zero. And you also need the user number, the username, and password. To close an Apple account, you need to contact customer support, since there's no automated way to close the account. You might not want to do this, however, because once the account is closed, all of the purchased apps and media can no longer be played, even on authorized devices. The permission cannot be passed on. If the account is not properly closed, it can be subjected to cybersecurity mischief. What happens to the numerous user logins that you've accumulated after you die or become too infirm to manipulate the keyboard? Some people have a plan, the digital equivalent of a living will, or having chosen a family option in a password management package such as LastPass, or have entrusted a book of passwords to a family member. The LastPass information should not be stored in the cloud, because you need access to the cloud to get to the passwords. By the way, that's a catch-22. Hackers are already targeting obviously abandoned profiles. In some cases, it's easier for fraudsters to gain hold of these accounts than the account holders themselves or their relatives, because crooks know the system better than you. Facebook users have reported receiving friend requests from accounts associated with dead friends and family members. Such requests appear to be on the result of cloning or hacking scams that see criminals try to add people on their site and then use that friendship as a way of stealing money from them or running other cons. Social media accounts, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg. Most people these days have 100-plus accounts, as figures from password and management software apps show, and these figures are only increasing over time. Many sites now offer a way for relatives and executives to memorialize or just delete an account. In other circumstances, services would rather you self-manage and plan ahead for your own demise. If the account is inactive for the specified length of time, then into the great divide it goes, and who knows where it goes. While a lot of services don't openly advertise what to do in the event of death on their website, they will give advice should you contact them, whether social network, email service, or web host. When there's no option available, though, people will forge their own path and take care of their so-called digital estate planning themselves. Users would be ill-advised to leave everything to their next of kin. Do some pre-handover diligence and take some time to ensure everything is locked down tight. If there's anything hugely important, you need them to know and tell them in advance. People may have bought digital purchases tied to certain platforms, games on Steam, or music on iTunes or Spotify. Legally, when you go, so do your files. In as much as anything you can't download and keep locally and is gone forever. That's because you're buying into a license to use a thing as opposed to buying the thing itself. There's nothing stopping someone from passing on a login to a family member so they can continue to make use of all the purchased content. Well, at least for now. At some point, all of our digital accounts tied to financial purchases will have some sort of average human lifespan timer attached to them. Millennials mark the first generation not to know life before and always on everywhere internet, which will become the norm from now on. Younger generations absolutely will demand reforms to the way we think about digital content, ownership, and inheritance. Take the time to find out what the rules are for removal of digital information from each LINE account. You may find on some social sites they have no written policy or procedure. Instructions should be given to the estate executor on how information data should be removed and deleted. Digital Estates is a program or an app provided by Everplans. It is a web resource for planning and organizing your life. Create, store, and share information documents that your loved ones might need. An Everplan is a complete archive of everything your loved ones will need should something happen to you. Securely stored wills, passwords, funeral wishes, and more in your own secure and shareable vault. Don't store this information in the cloud. When needed, it becomes a catch-22 if you don't have it on paper. You must first create and maintain a list of all online accounts with associated passwords, PIN numbers, and authorization IDs. This list needs to be updated whenever you have made changes with any of the online account. This needs to be available to your designated estate executor. Make sure the information is available to enable access to all electronic systems such as computers, tablets, routers, network SSIDs, and cell phones. PC Mag has a well-written article on how to delete your accounts from the internet. Do a search for the article by keying in PC Mag, delete your accounts from the internet, and the information provided is well worth reading. Remember, you also have financial accounts online. If also, have a personal website and make sure there's someone other than you that can maintain the registry. There are a startling number of services and publications online that do not let you delete an account, period. They generally state it up front in the terms of service, to the text that no one ever reads. If you suddenly decide to reclaim your privacy and want to obliterate yourself from the following services, well, you're SOL. Are you going to ask me what SOL stands for?
Oh my, bad planning, bad planning, bad planning. You know, Hank, when I die, I'm going to just cancel all of my accounts, my email and my Facebook and other social accounts. I'm going to make sure that I'm canceling even the New York Times. Everything will be canceled. Then I'll die, and I'll be able to die in peace. I won't worry about any of these things. What's that? You don't think that's a logical plan? I can't imagine why. Well, for those people who don't have the foresight that I have to be able to, know the date, time, and exact moment that they're going to die, well, I guess they have to have a different plan. As a matter of fact, there's one out there called Everplan, everplan.com. And for a nominal fee, which personally I think is exorbitant, $75 a year, they will take care of all of this for you. You just have to make a list of people who should be notified when you die and accounts that should be canceled, and they'll take care of it. And they'll even take care of the fact that someday when you don't answer their phone call or their email, maybe if the phone is out of order or you're out of town or you're sick, they have a fail-safe system in place that I think that part at least is very good. But again, I don't have to worry about these things. I'll take care of it myself.
How to get cybernetics and lighting to stop fighting. The ways that lighting gets installed, gets powered, and gets controlled are changing. It's lux and flux. But few people understand the details, especially with the confusing messages coming from companies that are trying to plant proprietary flags in what started as and will end as open systems turf. Marty has figured out what all that means for his cybernetic house, and his explanation here take a lot of it out of the dark.
A cybernetic house really should be able to take care of its own lights, don't you think? That's not to say that the people who live in it have no way to turn the lights on or off or change their brightness if they want to, but most of the time they shouldn't have to. On the subject of lighting, we really can't avoid having at least a brief philosophical discussion, or maybe it's more of a psychological discussion. It's not a terribly challenging technology exercise to design a house or a building that always gets the lights right, never needs light switches. But people get very uncomfortable when they're denied the freedom to control their surroundings. So my philosophy is that regardless of how much or how well I can automate lighting, I'd better not take away the switches. So let's consider just three elements in a very simplified look at lighting. There are the lights, almost certainly all LED in any new project. There are the light switches. And there are the automated lighting controls sitting in a rotting salad bar of choices out there. Wait, did I just say rotting? What exactly is the brown lettuce of lighting controls? For that matter, what exactly is a light switch? Hey, don't jump to conclusions. For your parents and grandparents, a light switch was something that could either interrupt or allow the AC power connection to reach your lights. It would pass 120 volts, and a pair, for example, of 60-watt incandescent bulbs would together draw 1 amp of current. Those were the days. Wasn't life nice and simple back then? You know what? The future will be simple, too, once we get there. It's the present that's a mess. And it's your fault. That's a collective view, referring to that herd of population that loves being enslaved by its self-assigned duties to command things through smartphone apps or eavesdropping voice interface pucks and gizmos. I have to say, in my view of the universe and of those poor consumers becoming slaves to their apps, it's my own philosophy that automation and freedom were never intended to be opposites. Automation, real automation, brings freedom. It doesn't take it away. True automation takes over things that had been chores to free you to do other things. The problem is in the low regard that vendors have for consumers, and the even lower regard that many consumers unwittingly have for themselves. Really, do you have to be told you have a choice before you know that you have a choice? Or is it that important to be one of the crowd chasing the latest, hippest, trendiest, stupidest fad? For the past 5 years, the home automation products you could buy off the shelf had two basic approaches to controlling lights. They might have you replace the light switch with their own variation, or they might offer a wall wart where you could plug in a lamp. There were a few variations, like the battery-operated motorized gizmo that would go over a rocker or toggle switch and operate them. The technical term for that, you know it, it's kludge. Oh, they also had light bulbs with the control interfaces built in. So whether it's in the wall or the wart, the little white lumps or the bulb, the control interface reached them with some kind of radio signal, Wi-Fi, or Bluetooth, or Z-Wave, or Zigbee, or one of those. A lot of home automation products clustered into their own little ecosystem, some involving handset apps, some involving cloud connections, some involving separate control boxes, but never without borders, limitations, cross-vendor compatibility. The home automation category is still tribal, even if all of the warring camps do try to pay tribute to the giant gods of voice command interfaces. It's the technical equivalent of adding hundreds of miles to a remote control. And a remote control is really not an automation device. If what makes it happen is you, it's not automation. Business and commercial lighting have their own camps with, again, mutual incompatibility remaining the standard. But at least there you can see some actual automation happening. It started with PIR sensors, PIR, passive infrared. They were triggered by a warm body moving. So when you went into a conference room or library or reading room and sat down to do some work, it would graciously turn its lights on for you automatically. And if you didn't move around enough for it to notice, it would time out and leave you in the dark automatically again until you learned its secret requirement and wiggled enough to get detected. Many hotel rooms hide PIR sensors, passive infrared sensors, in the thermostat housing. Those tend to be more completely automated environments where a room going vacant leads to turning off the lights, turning off the TV set, relaxing the thermostat, and letting housekeeping know that the room may be available for their ministrations. There are other sensors in the fray today, too, like ambient light sensors, so room lights are only turned on when their light is really needed, and in more advanced systems, only as much as they're needed. Some systems use hidden or not-so-hidden video surveillance cameras to determine when there's somebody in the room. Some home automation systems and many commercial lighting control systems follow the concept of themes. A conference room, for example, will be lighted one way when it's just people around a table, another way when there's a presentation on a screen. In a home theater room, if there are any of those left, well, that might be lighted one way if it's for watching pro sports on TV, another way for playing a console game, another way for family TV night, and one more way, if it's date night mood setting. Those different lighting scenes get set when somebody pushes or clicks on a button to switch to them. That's closer to automation. And I need to bring you a little closer to a really simple understanding of what automation is, so the word alone won't sucker you into thinking that something that claims it really offers it. At its simplest, these are the basics. At its simplest, automation involves three kinds of elements. There are sensors, not just environmental sensors or people detectors. Switches that people operate are also sensors. There are actuators, things that do things, like lighting fixtures that create light or motors that create motion. Anything that makes something happen in the real world. So if you have a light switch and you have a light, you have a sensor and you have an actuator, but you don't have automation. Beyond sensors and actuators, automation systems also need controllers, which could be as simple as a timer or as complex as a computer. One more time, if it doesn't have a sensor, a controller, and an actuator, it can't be automation. And even if it does have all three, it might not be automation. Go tell that puck on the table to turn on your light, and there has been no automation. Want a very quick understanding of that? If you have to be the one to trigger events, those events aren't happening automatically. Automation can run without people running it. Automation doesn't chain you to control interfaces in order for things to happen. Automation shouldn't negate freedom. It should create freedom. I'd love to simplify the discussion at this point. It's probably deserve it, folks. I want to focus on something familiar and understandable like lighting. I wish I could. Here's why I can't. The companies that make building control systems and the companies that make lighting control systems and the companies that make a big deal over their cloud services and the companies that see this as a growth opportunity, well, they are all proving much more competitive than cooperative. Try to get two competing control systems to interoperate. Go on, I dare you. There are deliberate barriers. A few companies are trying to get around this by developing bridge or gateway products, and I do wish them luck. But they're fighting giants. Worse, greedy giants. Turf-protective giants. And it's really unnecessary. This is a little like Prince Namor the Submariner battling Aquaman for control over Charlie the Tuna. Mature, proven, inexpensive lighting control systems are already out there. They've been there for decades. You've heard me talk about Dali, D-A-L-I, which is one of those. A very simple, two-wire, low-voltage bus that's very easy for lighting installers to run wiring to and connect, and for which there is an extremely broad range of products already available from scores of vendors. It was originally designed to control fluorescent fixtures, but it's very nicely suited to LED fixtures. There are also more complex standards developed for theatrical lighting controls. They use more wires, but allow more immediate and rapid changes among colors and in patterns. If that kind of lighting agility is needed, again, it's been around for decades. It's mature and proven, and a lot of products for it are already available. I'm pretty sure you get switches and the concept of sensors influencing lighting decisions are easy to understand. And I'm pretty sure you get the idea of being able to turn LED fixtures on or off or set their dimming and so on. Before I go, we should dive just a little deeper into the idea of the link between those, the sensors, the lights, and their control systems. This may confuse you a bit because the trade calls it a controller, even though it isn't a controller in the sense of an automation system. I'll call it a lighting controller. So don't be confused, okay? In fixture-based lighting, there's a device. The industry calls a controller, but we'll call a lighting controller, that gets the light to do what it should by controlling a driver. A driver is essentially a specialized DC power supply. So the lighting controller is really kind of an intermediary to interpret commands into changes in what the driver, that power supply, delivers to the LEDs. Now, I want to talk about the things that make decisions about the commands that get sent to those lighting controllers. In most lighting systems, that's a separate box you buy. Sometimes it looks like an industrial machine control panel. Sometimes it looks like a computer terminal. Directly or indirectly, the sensors and switches all have to connect to it. And so do the bus lines to the fixture, driver, lighting controller trio. Well, what happens if we make that cybernetic? What parts will we need to keep and which will we be able to take over? I can only tell you the approach I'm taking in our cybernetic house design. The sensors are connected through the network of 100 computer nodes on the wired Ethernet network. Anytime a sensor's reading or status changes, and that includes switch activations, the node to which it connects both logs the new value to the core database and sends a peer-to-peer message to the node that is responsible for lighting decisions. In computer terms, changes trigger interrupts, which trigger messages, which trigger interrupts, which trigger decisions, which may trigger actions, all in a sliver of a second. Any actions that happen are the result of that lighting management node's decisions, which get relayed through bridge devices to the appropriate Dolly networks, where whatever is being asked of the lighting system gets done. The whole of the control electronics, every bit of it, could fit in a shoebox. This, by the way, lets the entire lighting control system do something that those petty proprietary systems still haven't mastered. It can back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. Brookdale Computer User Group will be meeting Thursday, August the 23rd, at 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown Township Public Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC User Group will have their general meeting Tuesday, August the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Community Room at the Princeton Public Library, located at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, September the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club General Meeting is Thursday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, September the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need some technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have the following advice for computer club announcements. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page. And the computer club announcement should have the following: the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of week, and the date of meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue. Hey, we'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do. Back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.